Welcome to SF Commercial Property Conversations with Bruce Bean, where Bay Area investments meet expert insights. Get ready to unlock the strategies of commercial real estate success.
Good afternoon, Dave. This is Bruce Bean, and we are looking forward to having an interview with you. Dave DeBoe, just give us a little background on who you are and where you came from.
Hey, thanks a lot, Bruce. Well, I am a real estate investor based in beautiful British Columbia, Canada. I started investing way back in, 2001, if truth be told, when I was living in beautiful San Jose, Costa Rica. That's when I did my first couple of deals. And then I moved my poor Costa Rican family kicking and screaming up to the Great White North, which is home for me, and started doing real estate actively here in 2003. Started off with single family homes and then worked up into, first started off with creative, no money, low money down type deals, then into single family homes, and then eventually into multifamily properties eventually.
Well, that's fantastic. I mean, that's quite a jump going from San Jose to British Columbia, from very warm to very cold.
Well, I'm originally from British Columbia, so it wasn't a big shock for me, but my Costa Rican wife, my ex-wife now, no surprise, and our two Costa Rican kids, it was a shock for them, but they got used to it fairly quickly.
They got over it after the first couple of winters?
After the initial trauma. I brought them here in the summertime, though. I was smart that way.
That's fantastic. So looking back on this career, it sounds like you have gone through a number of different changes. What can you tell us about how the whole market has worked for you?
The real estate market?
Well, the your particular investment process and how you went through it. Were there any kind of little bumps along the way that you could talk about?
My goodness, yeah. There's all sorts of bumps along the way. I've got the lack of hair and the gray to show for it. So, yeah, I mean, initially I got off to a pretty good start, Bruce, at least in the volume of deals that I did. I did 18 deals in 18 months, which sounds pretty impressive, but some of those were just crappy little mobile homes in mobile home parks and crappy little single family homes. Anything that you can get into creatively typically has some sort of a challenge involved with it. So it was really good learning experience at the beginning, especially about finding and negotiating things with motivated sellers. But my big mistake was I was in the quick turn type of business. So it wasn't necessarily flipping. I wasn't really fixing anything up, but I was creatively getting into deals. And then I was usually using creative financing of some sort to sell those properties, which was good as an active way of investing in real estate. However, you know, fast forward 20 years, I sure as heck would wish I had have held on to some of those properties long-term instead of just selling them. So my biggest learning from that phase of my real estate investing career was, it's not all about the quick money. The real wealth in real estate is built up long-term. Then I transitioned from that into a form of rent-to-own real estate investing I call tenant-first or client-first rent-to-own. So we'd find a really good tenant buyer, go out house shopping for them, and then with a joint venture partner, we would purchase that property for our tenant buyer and lease-to-own it to them for the next 3 years or so until we helped them qualify for financing to purchase the home. So that was a good strategy. The challenge is with that, Bruce, that it is very market dependent, as I discovered. So I got about a dozen of those kind of deals up and going. And when I got them up and going, our local real estate market was pretty strong. It was going pretty strong. And then we hit the doldrums. It didn't necessarily tank, but it kind of just went flat for about 5 years. And when your whole strategy is based on buying a property at this price and selling it at a higher price in 2 or 3 years, then that really sucks. So I learned a hard lesson there that, I don't like those speculative kind of deals. And I had to suck it up on a few of those deals. I ended up, having to take over those deals and rent them out as traditional rentals for a while. And they weren't really they didn't cash flow very well as traditional rentals, so I was negative and had to wait a few years for things to stabilize before I could exit those properties. So that was another kind of lesson learned there. And then I got into multifamily properties, investing in multifamilies. And I was a co-GP on a couple of deals. And then more recently, I'm more of a real estate consultant. And these days, I invest passively with some of our clients in some of their deals.
So it sounds like over the years, you've figured out how to assess risk. So what would you say you didn't know in the beginning that now you know how to assess risk better?
Yeah. Well, again, I'm not a big fan of the what I consider the high risk strategies, which would be things like pre-construction condos. Not a big fan of those. I've seen a bunch of people get burned with that. I'm definitely not a big fan of doing flips because I don't know the first thing about construction, renovations, or anything like that. So I would get my derriere handed to me if I was getting into that. Plus, you know, it's market dependent. If you're in the middle of a flip and the market goes down or interest rates spike, as we've seen not that long ago, then you're in some hot water there. And then same thing with rent-to-own, because rent-to-own is basically a 2 or 3 year flip. You might not be actually doing any renovations on the property, but you're really, really dependent on the end price being higher than what you purchased it for in order to make any money. So I'm not a big fan of any of those strategies. My philosophy these days is buy them and hold them and take advantage of all the different profit centers in a real estate deal, you know, especially multifamily type properties, commercial properties. So all the way from cash flow to instant equity to mortgage pay down, that's a lovely one, depreciation, all of these kind of different profit centers that you don't necessarily get to take advantage of with shorter term strategies.
So it sounds like you've worked with a number of people. Are you a one-man band or do you work with a team of people?
Well, definitely work with a team. I no longer have in-house employees. I've got a bunch of subcontractors and virtual assistants that work with me. But yeah, at any given time, our team is around 12 to 15 people.
So how do you assess or what do you find is the challenge in terms of leadership in those areas?
Yeah, that's a really good question, Bruce. So for me, I guess my main challenge sometimes, I'm getting a little bit better at this, is not setting clear expectations up front. And I've gotten a lot better at this, but in the beginning, I kind of thought everybody could read my mind. And I realized that's not as easy as one would think.
Yeah, could you talk to my wife about that? Yeah.
No, I can't. My wife thinks I could read her mind as well.
I understand completely what you're saying. So yeah. Were there some significant, it sounds like you decided that having in-house employees was not all that great an idea and going to more of a consulting or independent group, independent subcontractors is a better approach.
For me, it is, Bruce. Yeah. I mean, in my days living in San Jose, Costa Rica, I had a language training company down there. Mm. And at one point we had 50 employees working for my company. And that was an absolute nightmare, to be perfectly frank with you. At one point here in Canada, I think I had 6 or 7 direct employees working for me. And, you know, at the end of the day, it's very, very expensive. Like having an employee is not just, you know, what your hourly rate is for that person. You know, you need to tack on another 50 or 60% to take into account everything else that's involved there. So that adds up pretty quickly.
Yeah. So it sounds like you've gotten the things sort of balanced out here in terms of your work-life balance. And over the years, you've probably gone through those periods where like myself, you kind of go crazy with work and the home life does not always go that well. So,
yeah. Anyway. Well, you know, I've got a divorce to show for it. So, yeah, there's been hiccups along the way, that's for sure, Bruce. But yeah, these days, knock on wood, thankfully, I've got a lovely wife who is very understanding. My kids are both grown up and doing their own thing. And no, the work-life balance is really good. We spend a lot of time traveling. That's kind of our passion, my wife and myself. So good, at least 3 times a year, we're taking a fairly major trip. We just got back from Japan and Korea a couple of weeks ago. We did a Caribbean cruise at the beginning of the year, did several weeks in Mexico in December. Coming up in the next few months, we're going to be, where are we going? We're off to the Balkans.
Oh, wow.
No, the Baltics. Sorry. Balkans, Baltics. I get those confused, but we're going to the Baltics. Looking forward to that. So yeah, we really enjoy traveling.
Well, it sounds like the over the years, even though you've had some bumps along the way, you've come out on top so that you can have the kind of the lifestyle that you now want. I think that's what a lot of listeners are thinking about is how do I get there? So.
Yeah. Well, it's for me, it's interesting, Bruce, because at least at this point, I don't really ever want to retire. Like, I really enjoy what I do. What I want to be able to do is live life on my own terms, right? So work the way I want to work, travel when I want to travel, do what I want to do when I want to do it, with whom I want to do it, that sort of thing. And I'm very, very blessed that I've set things up so that I can largely do that how I like to.
So along the way, can you cite any one person or book or podcast or something that really helped you?
Well, this podcast is a hell of a good one. If I can blow some smoke
Oh,
up your skirt there, my friend. Okay, but in all seriousness, you know, there is a book that always just sticks out for me that had a big impact, and I enjoy reading. But the one that really pops out is something called The Ultimate Sales Machine by Chet Holmes. And this was written quite a few years ago. The gentleman has passed away since then. But it's one of the best marketing and sales books and just common sense approaches to business, marketing, sales that I've ever read. And it's all in one package. So I would highly recommend that one.
wow, that's very interesting. I'd love to. I'm going to look that up right away. I've never heard of that book. So, are you familiar with the motivational sequence, the Murray's motivational sequence? Anyway, that's probably in that book. It's an interesting process. So just to, out of curiosity, kind of going back to your transactions. For me, it's always tough to kind of pre-qualify somebody when they're coming in. Are they a good investor? Do they have money? Is this a good project? How do you go about doing that?
When I'm raising capital for investors, how do I pre-qualify them? A couple of different ways, Bruce. So one way is I let technology do a lot of the heavy lifting for me, right? So I'm big into marketing. I'm a marketing nerd, so I really enjoy that. So we almost take people through a funnel, so to speak. So for example, when we're raising capital, it's typically a lot of times it's from our existing network of connections. So we'll have people kind of go through some what I call edutaining marketing that we put out. We'll have them self-identify. We'll have them book in a call on our Calendly or what have you. And right in there'll be a bit of a questionnaire that we ask people that kind of gets them pre-qualified. Plus, quite often, when they're booking in, they've watched some sort of video or training or whatnot, where I explain what I'm looking for from my ideal investor. And that usually talks about, you know, net worth, income qualifications, that sort of thing, the minimum amount that we're looking for the deal, yada, yada, that sort of thing. So by the time they've booked in a call, they've already kind of pre-qualified themselves.
So how do you build that trust in that relationship, given all the kind of scams that are out there? I'm sure people are nervous about, putting money into a transaction. So how do you get over that hurdle?
Yeah, well, really, it's about constant, consistent, what I call edutaining communication. So I don't wait until I've got a deal on the go and then try to raise the capital. What I'm doing all the time is I'm consistently having meetings with prospective investors and getting them signed off on something like a letter of intent or an expression of interest. So we've kind of, you know, by the time we get a deal, we've already got a number of people lined up for it. that are kind of pre-qualified and have shown some serious interest, because they've, it's not a legally binding document, but it's a much better commitment than trying to get somebody to, you know, it's just said, hey, Bruce, when you got a deal, let me know, I might be interested at that time, right? So that's the process. It's all about that edutaining communication, get them to self-identify, to book a call, have a one-on-one conversation with the person, and, you know, make sure that they're a good fit for you and I'm a good fit for them, and then get them signed up via an expression of interest.
So then when you then actually buy a property, how do you take care of it afterwards? Do you have a property management group? What happens after the purchase?
Yeah. So again, typically the last number of years, Bruce, I've been on the other end. I've been the investor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
passively investing with people. But when I was an active GP partner on a few properties, we had professional property management take care of those properties.
Yeah. So they'd report to you and the funds would go.
And then we'd have quarterly meetings with our investor partners and go over things at that time.
Yeah. Yeah. So all good. So given all that information, is there any advice that you'd like to glean to the listeners about getting into this particular market in terms of putting money into a transaction?
I'm in different markets these days, Bruce. So yeah, I don't have a specific market that I'm in. I'm more of a passive investor. But if you're asking what your listeners as prospective investors should be looking for in a joint venture partner or a GP or somebody who's raising capital for a deal, lots of things. Lots of things. And up here in Canada, there's you know, with the current situation and whatnot, there have been a lot of relatively big names that have gone down in flames recently because, you know, interest rates and whatnot and their deals just didn't work out. And a big red flag is if the person who is raising the capital does not have a good track record, does not have significant experience, if they don't have referrals, recommendations, testimonials, this kind of thing, if they're just getting started, that for me would be a big red flag. I don't want to be anybody's guinea pig. The other thing you definitely want to look at is how are you secured with your investment? So like I said, there have been a lot of people recently that have lost a lot of money because they were just doing promissory notes, unsecured promissory notes, believe it or not. People who should know better. But the person that they were investing with, or the people they were investing with, were fairly high profile. So they had a lot of the, you know, know, like, and trust factor already in place there. They had a good track record. They had lots of experience. So people that should have known better otherwise just kind of let their guard down and did these unsecured investments and lost a lot of money. So make sure that you are secured. Make sure that there's proper legal documentation, whatever that's looking like, if it's an offering memorandum, if it's a joint venture agreement, if it's a syndication. Have your lawyer look over things, even if you have to spend a few bucks for that. Make sure you get your own independent legal advice about the deal that you're getting into. And listen to your spidey senses. Like if you've got a feeling in the pit of your stomach that something's not quite right, listen to it. You know, I'd rather err on the side of caution than charge in and lose a lot of money. So listen to your gut.
So if you're a young person and you want to get into this business and you don't have a track record, is there a way to do that?
Yeah, simple solution. Partner with somebody who does have a hell of a good track record. Do a few deals with that person. Bring value however you can to the table and then build up that track record over time very, very quickly. You can do it very, very quickly by working with a very experienced
investors. Yeah. And do you help people kind of team up with other people?
No, not
that way. Yeah. No. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, this has been very enlightening for me. I appreciate all your time here today.
My pleasure, Bruce. Likewise.
I look forward to talking to you in the future.
Likewise, my friend. Thank you very much.
All right.
That's a wrap on today's journey through the SF commercial real estate scene. Ready to share your story? Visit sfcommercialconversations.com/guest. Your insights could lead the next conversation.